Just a couple of announcements. You will all be receiving, you may already have received emails for the online course evaluations. There's a link in the email, and it's your chance to evaluate this course. If you seek revenge, this is your opportunity. If you find that this has been a rewarding and worthwhile class for you to take, you can also express those views as well. There's a place on the online evaluations for you to give actual comments, not just these scores. And I really welcome you, encourage you to do so. Comments are more useful than just, blanket ranking of on various criteria. So if you feel so inclined, I definitely look over all the comments, and I do take them seriously in thinking about how I can improve the course. Also, I won't have office hours this week because of my talk today at the Earth Day event, and then on Friday I'll be in New York for a meeting. I would be available Thursday afternoon, if there's any of you who would like to have office hours, just let me know, and I'll be available in my office Thursday afternoon. All right, today we're going to be exploring a topic which, as I've said, I think most people, if we're asked the question, what do you think would be a topic in a course on American society, how it really works, taught in a sociology department, I think most people wouldn't think of taxation as a likely topic. It either seems too specialized, too narrow a topic, or perhaps kind of too boring for a sociology course. I'm going to make an argument that I think taxation and how we think about it is also really fundamental to how we think about democracy. If you want an effective democracy that really enables us to take command collectively of our common fate, to shape our futures through our public policies, we have to have resources to be able to do this. And taxation turns out to be the way in which those resources are acquired. And the problem of taxation is therefore, in some sense, a fundamental problem about the relationship between the public and the private, and thus democracy and freedom, that is our collective self-determination versus our individual self-determination. It ends up being really a pivotal idea. And therefore, I think it's worth spending the time. And we'll begin by a kind of simple question. Turns out to not have such simple answers. What exactly is taxation? What is this phenomenon? Today, by the way, is tax day in the United States. This is the day where your parents are, and maybe many of you as well, if you file your own income taxes, where taxes are filed. It's a day of either celebration or mourning, depending upon one's view of taxation. What are taxes? There are two kinds of answers to this question. The first answer, what are taxes? It's the public taking something from the private. You know, everybody earns income through economic activity. You earn it, it's yours. Taxation is the government taking money away from citizens and using it to pay for government activities. This kind of almost seems commonsensical. I mean, we have the everyday experience, if you're working, of going to a job and getting paid. And the payment clearly is earnings given to you for the services you've rendered. And the money that you've received seems like it's yours. You generated it through your activity. And the taxes that are deducted from that look like someone has taken something away from you. In the extreme version of this, which is a position taken by some purist libertarians, taxation is viewed as a kind of theft. You know, so long as you yourself don't agree with all of the things taxes are being used for, even if those uses were decided democratically. But if you yourself don't agree with some of those uses, then the taxes you are paying are being coercively taken from you. And this is what theft is, right? That's theft is somebody using coercion to take something that belongs to you. But even if you reject that extreme view, that all taxation is theft, that's a slogan that comes from the 19th century anarchists, taxation is theft. There's another version that says property is theft, but taxation is theft was a kind of anarchist view of the state. Even if you don't agree with that, most people still have in their gut feeling that when they're paying taxes, they're giving up something that belongs to them. Taxation is a kind of personal sacrifice. So that's, I think, the most common view. And it's interesting because it's one of these examples of a common sense idea that's constantly ratified in everyday experience. You don't exactly have to be taught that. You know, it's not that propaganda. We don't have ads on television saying literally this: every tax you pay is being taken from you. We do have politicians who say things like, why should we cut taxes? Because you know better how to spend your money than the government does. You may have heard that discourse in some conservative politicians who are opposed to taxation. You know better how to spend your money than the government does. Scott Walker has defended tax cuts on these grounds, giving money back to taxpayers because they know best how to spend their money. Again, that's affirming the idea that the money is yours and it's being extracted or taken away from you. Common sense corresponds to everyday, I don't want this to happen. Postpone, there we go. But there's another view, and that's to think of taxation as the division of the total income that's generated through our complex, cooperative, interdependent forms of economic activity, how to divide the total income that's generated through those activities into a part that's used for public purposes and a part that's used for private purposes. In this view, people don't actually have some inherent connection to the income they earn. Rather, we all cooperatively engage in a social process that generates the total economic pie, and then we have to figure out how to allocate it between public and private purposes. And there's all sorts of ways you could do this. It turns out that if you are living in a market economy with very decentralized decision-making, which is a good thing. We want people to be able to choose what jobs they have, and we want people to be able to choose whether or not they want to invest in particular activities. That's all good. We live in a market economy where this grand social cooperation that produces the total economic pie is done through this extraordinarily decentralized process. And in such a system, the simplest way to divide the total pie into a part used for our democratic collective purposes and a part used for our private personal self-determination, you know, that public versus private allocation, the simplest way is to just pay people for the work they do and then have taxes to partition part of that money back to the public purposes. But rather than seeing that as taking something away that rightfully belongs to each person, it's just the mechanism we use to create the pool of common resources that we use for public resources, for public purposes, and the set of private resources that people can use for their own purposes. Taxation is the way of accomplishing this difficult task of dividing the pie between public and private purposes in a capitalist economy. Now, in this way of thinking about taxation, it's perfectly reasonable to make an argument that taxes might be too high or too low, because one might believe too much of our total resources are being allocated to either public or private purposes. They're not too high because too much has been taken away from me. for my private purposes. No, taxes would be too high if we feel we don't need that much resources to deal with our common collective problems. If you feel that our public infrastructure is just fine and we don't need, you know, to improve public transportation, our roads, our bridges, if you think we've spent too much on street repairs, you have a particular fondness for potholes, well, then you could say, yes, I think that we have partitioned too much money into the public sphere. We should cut it back. If you feel that the gaps in what you want to, in what people generally want to do in their private lives are bigger than the gaps in what we need to do in our public lives, then you might want to say we need to allocate more money to personal choice that doesn't have to take into consideration the common good, rather than allocating so much resources to collective goods. On the other hand, if you feel there's a vast number of things that are not being taken care of, that ranging from the environment to research to healthcare to education, if you feel that tuitions have risen too high because less tax money is being allocated to public universities, for example, then you might decide, no, we've gone too far and we need to allocate more of our total social resources to public purposes. But the debate should be about the appropriate division between the private allocation of resources and the public use of resources, and not about taking money away from me and giving it to the government. Now, if you were to ask the question, in whose interests is it to argue that taxation is basically a kind of coercive extraction from individuals rather than a way of solving our common problems? Who really benefits from this particular vision? In whose interest is it to insist that taxation is the way the government takes your money? Is this understanding of taxation more in the interests of rich and powerful people than ordinary citizens or the poor? So one way of assessing an argument is to ask the question, whose interests are served by such arguments? Now that, of course, doesn't prove anything. It doesn't, showing that a particular view serves the interests of a privileged group doesn't show that the view is incorrect. But it should lead one to be suspicious. When people proclaim certain views that turn out to be very much in their own self-interest, one at least should be skeptical and believe that perhaps they are supporting those views, or they fervently believe in them, at least in part because they do serve their interests. Well, I support, I think it's obvious, the view that taxation is not an extraction from persons. Taxation is a way of solving a collective problem. And it's a pretty good way of doing it. But there are many different kinds of taxes, and you can solve this problem in ways. Once you decide you do need taxes, because we do have collective problems to solve and you need resources for it, then there's a variety of different ways that you can actually get the taxes. Given that we begin with a decentralized system in which people acquire their income, then the tax system can either act as a way of intensifying the inequalities that are generated by that decentralized system of acquiring income, or the tax system itself could also serve the purpose of reducing the inequalities that exist in this decentralized market-based way of acquiring incomes. So it's not enough to say, yes, we've decided we need taxes. Maybe you agree with my view, maybe you don't, that it's a partition of the total pie into two parts. We still face this problem of how to actually get the taxes. And this brings up the question of what constitutes a fair way of taxing. If we're going to have taxes, We can think of all sorts of ways that would be dreadfully unfair. And perhaps we can come up with ways of extracting taxes, of generating our taxes for these public purposes that satisfy some condition of fairness. Here are three different kinds of taxes. And each of them we can think of as responding to a different vision of what constitutes fairness. So first, a tax that takes the form of everyone pays the same tax, the same amount. This is called a poll tax. Everybody pays $1,000 a year. Very few people support a poll tax anymore. It used to be a common form of taxation because it's simple. You know, you don't need to know anything about the person to gather a poll tax. In some parts of the world, in the colonial world, there was a kind of tax called a hut tax, in which every household had to pay a tax of some amount, let's say it's $100 a year, on their hut. Now, here's the thing about that nasty tax in a colonial situation. Most people in those settings didn't earn any income. That is, they were subsistence agriculturalists. They did not generate cash income. In order to pay the hut tax, therefore, they had to enter the market. And that was the purpose of the hut tax. The actual purpose of the hut tax was not so much to gather the revenues from the tax, although it did that, but it was to force peasants from the land who lived in more communal kind of agrarian settings without the usual sense of property rights and certainly without much market interaction. It was to force them to actually earn cash so they could pay the tax. And this was a crucial way in places like Southern Africa that African labor was recruited to the mines. If you want miners to work in the mines and the vast majority of your population lives in stable subsistence agricultural communities, how are you going to get those workers to decide to go work in the mines? If you force the households, everybody to pay the same tax, then you have to earn income and you recruit the young men in the family to be migrant laborers to work in the mines. We have some kinds of things in the United States that come awfully close to a poll tax. They're not usually thought of that way. But think about vehicle registration fees. Now, if you live in a part of the country where you really do need a car, there's no public transportation. If you're in a rural area, if you want to get around, you need access to a car. And regardless of your income, you pay the same vehicle registration fee. That's basically a tax. We call it a user fee, but user fees are really only user fees if they're pretty discretionary, if you can decide whether or not you're going to take advantage of it. There's a debate in Wisconsin right now about state parks, for example. It used to be that our state parks were heavily subsidized by tax money, and that the fees to spend the day or to camp were very low. And the idea was that shouldn't in any way impede anybody from being able to use the state parks. In recent years, the tax subsidies have declined. I think they're basically gone at this point for the basic maintenance of the camping facilities. And thus, the fees have to cover, the fees plus donations plus other ways that money are raised have to cover the costs. Well, those are user fees because it's a relatively small percentage of the population in Wisconsin that uses that particular public facility. But, it says plug in my power source. I'm obviously a little more distracted today because of this upcoming debate with some sociologists always get a little anxious when they debate economists. Economists have this edge. You know, it's a kind of imperialist academic discipline where they they exude such a sense of intellectual superiority that even if one doesn't believe it, one, meaning me, in such debates always feel, if not exactly intimidated, it just the anxiety level as to what's going to happen is higher when I'm in a public discussion with economists than with fellow, you know, laid-back sociologists. Okay, so poll taxes exist in residual form, but I just don't think anybody would say we should fund the military in the United States through a poll tax where everybody pays the same amount. You know, that just is not a plausible tax system. A much more plausible form of taxation, which many people think is in fact fair, is called a flat tax. In a flat tax, everybody pays the same percentage of their income. If we had a flat tax, I think the flat tax proposals that are circulating are for something like a 20% income tax on everybody. And some versions say, let's get rid of all deductions. It's a simple one-page tax form. You have your total income from all sources, and you just pay 20% of it in taxation, regardless of the level of your income. And in some ways, that kind of seems fair. Everybody is paying the same percentage. There's no way for wealthy people, for example, to use what are called loopholes to reduce their tax liability to zero. Everybody pays 20%, end of story. It was a big deal in the 2012 election when it was revealed that Mitt Romney paid a lower percentage of his income in taxes than his secretaries because he had so many deductions. Well, a flat tax wouldn't allow that, and that somehow, for many people, seems fair. But there's a third conception. Everyone should have the same tax burden. Everyone should make the same sacrifice. That's called, God, I'm really having a lot of action coming. Did that pop up on the screen or just on my, yeah, it did, okay. Everybody should have the same tax burden. That's called a progressive tax. So we have three logics. Everybody pays the same amount, the same percentage, or the same burden. Amount, percentage, and burden. Let's look at the flat tax idea and see what it looks like. So compare two people. One earns $10,000 a year, the other earns $100,000 a year. Suppose the flat tax is 25%. This means that the poorer person pays $2,500 in taxes, and the affluent person pays $25,000 in taxes. This means that the better off person pays 10 times as much. Right? They pay 10 times as much. If these two people were the only taxpayers, the richer person would pay over 90% of total taxes for the common good. Is that fair? Some people look at that and say, that's not fair. It's not fair that one person should pay for 90% of the taxes for the common good. That's an extremely unequal contribution to the common good. So a flat tax, which on the one hand looks kind of fair, everybody's paying the same percentage, it ends up, if you actually look at how much in dollars people are paying, the rich are paying way, way more than the poor for the common good. Is that fair? Well, this raises the question that is most acutely posed in the third version. What is an equal burden? What does that really mean when we're talking about something like taxation? Well, that's a question I want to pose to you. We'll use this, treat this as one of our two-minute, you know, speed discussions. Turn to people in your immediate vicinity and talk about it. What is the idea behind equal burden, and how should we think about that if we're talking about contributions to the common good, to the public budget? Turn to your neighbors. Start talking. 2 minutes. Well, I hear the volume going down. It's not been not quite 2 minutes, but I think that's a good test of the ideas having been processed. All right, so what does equal burden mean for taxation? Come on, somebody from in the middle of the classroom. Raise your hand. Yeah. So there's something about we have to tax people in such a way that they, in some sense or other, have a similar feeling. Let's give a little more precision to that. Somebody else. Somebody from over there, come on. One of you guys. In that part of the room. I hate to just call on somebody without a hand going up. That's can be considered cruel and unusual punishment. Like in a law school, you know, in a law class, that's what the professor does. They say, come on, you, what do you think about this case? Somebody from there, come on, raise your hand. You got, somebody has a, yeah.
So we're talking about like how we found that like the equal like whole tax and then the same amount wouldn't be fair because like 10% to a worker is gonna be different than 10% to a worker. Sure, no, we were saying like a certain amount like 10,000 to like a worker is gonna be different for
So one intuition then is that the same percentage is actually reflects the same burden. Yeah.
Well, that's like tax brackets too. So like the higher amount of income is taxed at a higher rate. That's going to affect everyone. So like if you have like a
because it will affect them less. So the first intervention said they should feel it the same way, and now you've given that a little bit more clarity by saying you need to have an actually higher percentage because otherwise it will affect them less. So I think that's getting at the idea. So let's go through an example. Here's just an arithmetic example, a simple one. We're back to the same two folks, you know, our person who earns $10,000 a year and a person who earns $100,000 a year. And then suppose that they each get a raise of $10,000. So suddenly, one person earns $20,000 and the other earns $110,000. They've gotten an additional $10,000. And that additional $10,000 is going to be taxed. What does it mean for them to have an equal burden or equal sacrifice in the taxation on this additional income? On the new income which they just earned. So let's suppose there's a flat tax of 25%. This means that the poor person and the affluent person each pay an additional $2,500 in taxes because they have this additional $10,000 of income. But is it really the case that $2,500 is the same burden on a person earning $20,000 as it is on a person earning $110,000? Does it feel the same? Does it imply the same kind of sacrifice I mean, if we think of taxation as a burden, as a sacrifice, I mean, of course, that reflects the idea that somebody is taking something away from you. If we feel it, look at it that way, is the impact on the life of a 20,000 earning person a year of giving up $2,500 the same as a $110,000 person a year giving up $2,500? Well, I think most people would say that that's not right. How much income would somebody earning $110,000 have to give up to be the equivalent sacrifice as $2,500 for somebody earning $25,000? Now, that's a tough question. I mean, to actually answer that question, exactly how much should the extra taxes be imposed on the higher earners be? Is $5,000 for a $110,000 person the equivalent of $2,500 for a $20,000 person? Is it twice the rate? Is it three times the rate? Well, that's a tough problem. It's not an intractable problem. You could do research. There's various nifty strategies for doing research to try to get a sense of what's the value in a person's experience of additional income depending upon what their level of income is. And this is the key idea from economics, that there is declining marginal utility of money. As you earn more, each additional dollar matters less. Each additional dollar matters less. It's interesting that that's not, the declining marginal utility only kicks in when you're above the sort of average income of the cultural environment in which you live. The value of an additional dollar is basically linear. Each dollar matters about the same amount until you get somewhere above the median. And research has consistently shown that it's linear and then it curves. Then each additional dollar is worth less. Above a certain income, the more you earn, the less difference an additional dollar makes to your well-being, and therefore the higher the rate of taxation has to be to make it pinch in the same way, to create the same burden. Well, let me show you how this actually works in the American context. So these are the tax rates for people in different levels of income in the United States for this tax year. People are taxed at 10% on their income from zero to $9,325. This is income after you take various deductions, right? So you're allowed what's called a personal deduction and various other deductions. Let's not worry about that problem for the moment. You're taxed at 15% between $9,325 and $37,950, and so on. We now have seven tax brackets. There's this very weird little tiny tax bracket, and this obviously had something to do with strange negotiations that occurred in Congress. Bracket six goes from $416,700 to $418,400. You know, almost nobody is going to be in bracket six because it's such a small window. And who knows why that happened? I mean, you can imagine the tax writing committees were arguing about where to make the cutoffs. And I suspect what was happening was there was a proposal to have the higher rate of bracket 7, 39.6%, kick in at what is now bracket 6. And somebody, for some reason, demanded that there be this tiny little window. But that's the basic tax rates. But here's how you calculate it. So suppose a person earns $100,000. That's this character we've been discussing. On the first $9,325, they would pay $932 of tax. On the income they earn in the second bracket, they would pay 15%, or 4,293. On the income that they earn in the third bracket, they would pay 25%, or 13,000 plus. And in the income they earn in the fourth bracket, they earn just a little bit in the fourth bracket because their income is 100,000 and the fourth bracket only kicks in at 91,900. So on that $8,000 that they earned in that top, in what for them is their top bracket, they would pay a total of 2,268. So they pay a total of $20,981 or a 21% tax on their $100,000 income. And that's what your TurboTax program, if you use TurboTax, does, calculates. Or if you look at the tax tables on the tax form, it's you can calculate it by hand. That's called a progressive tax system. The progressive tax system is the one that corresponds to the idea that a fair tax imposes an equal burden on all taxpayers. A flat tax does not impose an equal burden on all taxpayers. A flat tax imposes a bigger burden on those least able to pay. And a poll tax is the most worst, is the least fair of all in terms of an equal burden principle. It imposes a higher percentage of tax rates on the people who earn the least. So it's worse than a flat tax. When I was president of the American Sociological Association, we had a huge debate in what's called the Council of the Association over the dues of members of the association. So there's a dues structure. So if you're a poor, bedraggled graduate student, you pay less than if you're an assistant professor, and they have income brackets. So if you earn over $100,000 a year, you pay a higher annual dues than if you earn only $25,000 a year, right? So there's a higher rate as you go up. Well, I calculated what the actual percentage was, treating the dues as a tax. So one way of thinking about a professional association is this is like a democracy for our profession. It's how we regulate the common affairs and our common purposes as members of the noble world of sociologists. And so we had this problem. These taxes are voluntary. You don't have to join. But there's lots of good reasons to be a member. And so I was saying, well, let's imagine that the dues should be thought of as a tax. And what I showed was we didn't even have a flat tax. We charged, even with our higher dues for wealthier members, they were paying a much smaller percentage of their income for their ASA, American Sociological Association membership. So since the ASA is filled with, liberal do-gooders like me, and they people with strong sense of social justice and fairness, I figured I could propose to the council that we move to a more progressive tax system in which we at least ensured that the wealthier members of the association would pay at least a slightly higher percentage of their income in dues. Now, what that did was created a very high dues rate for higher income people. The dues for a full professor at a good university would be $600 a year. In order to be the equivalent, in this progressive tax sense, of the dues of an assistant professor in a community college or something. And people were really uncomfortable about it. And they were uncomfortable because they said, people just won't pay it. They'll quit the organization. They won't see it as worth it. Now, that's the problem when your tax system relies on voluntary taxation. Voluntary taxation, each person asks, is it worth it to me, rather than what's my obligation to the community? Unfortunately, the ASA doesn't have the power to enforce taxation on its members. I say unfortunately because I think this is an obligation that should be imposed on members of the profession. But the result was that the council did not approve my particular tax schedule. It was seen as too radical for the membership. They would not accept it. But they did it. They did make it still a steeper gradient, closer to a flat tax in the end. All right. That's the basic logic of our tax system. We do have a mildly progressive tax system in the US. But then the system gets complicated. Tax system complexity. This is a really important thing to get your head around, why we have such a complex tax code. Some people believe that it would be just a good thing for it to be simple, as if simplicity itself is a value. When you live in a complex world where the tax system is trying to accomplish all sorts of things, it's not at all obvious that we want the simplest possible tax code. We may want lots and lots of complexities, because the complexities can then reflect the lives of persons. So let's look at three types of complexities. First, you have this basic problem. What is taxable income? How do we calculate taxable income? So here's an example. You have a family with five children versus a single adult earning the same amount of income. Should we treat that as the same amount? Should we say that the income of a household with five children and a single person, each household earns $100,000 a year, is that really the same? $100,000 a year, is it really the same? One is tempted to say, well, we need a denominator. We need to divide that amount of money by the number of people whose lives depend upon it. It just doesn't seem right to tax a family with five children and a single person earning both $100,000 at the same rates. Some kind of adjustment, one might think, needs to be made. What about a person with large medical expenses versus a person with no medical expenses? Again, they earn the same amount. But one person had huge medical expenses because of surgery or getting hit by I didn't actually have any medical expenses. The car insurance covered it, but if I didn't have car insurance, gets hit by a car while biking on a pleasant November day. A person whose house is destroyed by a hurricane versus a person whose house is undamaged, again, earning the same amount of money. Should all of these taxes, all these people be taxed at the same rate just on the basis of their official, aggregate income? Well, I think most people who think about this say, no, there needs to be some way of adjusting this. So we need to distinguish between total income and taxable income. And tax deductions, allowing these kinds of variations to be reflected by deducting from your income, that's one good solution, but it adds complexity. Then you have to document all of these particulars. A second kind of complexity. So we have tax deductions which are designed to accommodate the very different circumstances of life that people have, five children versus no children. But tax deductions are also a policy tool to create incentives for people to do certain things in the public interest. this is the problem of what is called tax expenditures. Tax expenditures. Let me explain. So, green energy. We want to move as rapidly as possible from a world in which we burn fossil fuels and emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to a world where we have much less carbon emissions. That's a good public policy, I think. I think we need a whole host of public policies to encourage that transition, to decarbonize our energy system and to have energy conservation. Well, one way to do this is to give tax breaks to individuals to weatherize their houses or for companies to invest in solar panels. So the way that would work is if you spend $5,000 to weatherize your house, you can deduct that $5,000 from your income. And if you would have paid 20% tax on that $5,000, if that was the bracket you were in, that would mean you would get $1,000 tax refund. That is, of the $5,000 you spent, you take it off of your income, that would reduce your income tax liability by $1,000. Now, that's exactly the same as the government paying you $1,000 to weatherize your house. That's why it's called a tax expenditure. It creates an incentive because the government says, I'm going to make it cheaper for you than it would otherwise be. I'm going to pay you $1,000 to weatherize your house, and then you go out and spend $5,000 to the weatherizing company, but it only costs you $4,000. Home mortgage interest deduction. If you think home ownership is a good public policy, so there's lots of reasons to think that our communities are more stable, people care about them, they will worry about their neighborhoods more if they own their homes than if they don't. So if you think this is a good public policy, then you might want to encourage people to buy their own homes. And one way of doing that is to have the interest payments on your mortgages, that is on the loans you take out to buy a house, to have the interest payments on mortgages treated as a tax deduction. Again, what that does is it funnels government money, it funnels part of our collective resources that we gather in the tax system back to individuals in order to encourage them to buy houses or at least make it easier for them to do so. Charitable contributions. If you give $10,000 to a charity, and your marginal rate was 35%. So you're in that upper income but not super rich category. You're earning $200,000 a year. So you're a pretty affluent family. That puts you in the top 7 or 8% in the United States if a household earns $200,000 a year, more or less. You're a affluent earner. You give $10,000 to charities. The government then gives you $3,500 back in tax funds, tax refunds. So your $10,000 contribution actually only cost you $6,500. In effect, what the government is doing is giving you, the charities of your choice, $3,500. That's a pretty good deal. I'll give my church $6,500 and the government will give it $3,500. That's a way of ponying up how much your church gets. Now, the way we do it is that you give the church $10,000 and you get back from the government $3,500. But that's exactly the same as if we had we could have a different system where the government says, you tell us how much you contributed, and then here's how much we will match your funds with. If you contribute $6,500, we'll give your church $3,500. This is really the logic of charitable donations. It's two ways the government can allocate money to various kinds of nonprofit activity in the public interest. So here's one way. You could set up a government agency, allocate funds to that agency, institute a bureaucratic procedure for giving out grants. That's a pretty good way for certain sorts of things. The National Science Foundation gives grants to scientists and even to sociologists occasionally. That's the government setting up an agency, giving it a budget, and then that agency allocates its budget for projects in the public interest. The National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts. These are all government-funded agencies that allocate taxpayer money for worthy or unworthy, depending upon your view, projects. But there's another way you could do it. You could allow tax deductions for individual contributions to nonprofit organizations. This is a way of allocating government money to nonprofit organizations that's highly decentralized. And you can think of it as a decentralized participatory form of government spending. You, the taxpayer, get to decide how to allocate government money directly by your own choices. But you got to have skin in the game. That is, you've got to make a contribution, and then the government will pony up additional money. The people directly decide how to allocate public funds. That's what charitable deductions are. It's a complexity to the tax code, to be sure, but it's a complexity that has this interesting kind of democratic flavor to it. It's a complexity that allows citizen taxpayers, well, any taxpayer, you don't have to be a citizen, to allocate some of the government's money to the purposes that you care. The government spends billions of dollars a year on religion this way. You think we have separation of church and state. Well, we do, in the sense that the government itself doesn't decide how much money to fund into religion. We don't have an established church. But the government allocates billions and billions of dollars directly to churches in the form of tax expenditures. Since donations, religious donations are, I think for good reason, tax deductions. So here's the problem with charitable donations. I mean, I'm in favor of such a system, but it has a problem. The richer you are, the more you are in a position to vote for government spending on things you like. That gets a little creepy sometimes when you think about it. If you're very rich, you have a very high marginal tax rate. If you're in that super rich category, remember, it got up to 39.6%. For some reason, they didn't make it a nice round 40%. Let's round it up for purposes. You're in this 40% bracket. So if you are you earn $1 million a year, and you give $200,000 to a cause that you like, it's only going to cost you $120,000. The government is going to contribute $80,000 to that. $80,000 of taxpayers' money, of the common pool of taxed resources, to that charity. That means the richer you are, the bigger your ability to allocate public money for nonprofit charitable purposes. And it gets even dicier because of changes in the tax law, which allow certain kinds of organizations that are called welfare organizations to be tax-free and yet to spend a very high percentage of their revenues for political purposes, for lobbying, for attack ads in political campaigns. And so you get this weird situation in which, while we have very limited government funding of political campaigns, we have massive government funding of private donations to organizations that are, for all intents and purposes, engaged in political campaigns. And the richer you are, the bigger the government's contribution to that process. That is very different, remember, the democracy dollars idea for campaign finance reform, where every citizen gets the same amount of money to allocate for political purposes. That's also allowing individuals to decide what to do with tax money for political purposes, but it gives citizens an equal claim on the public purse for that purpose. The alternative to charitable donations, then, as a way of letting citizens allocate directly on the basis of their own preferences part of the public budget, the alternative is what's called a non-refundable tax credit targeted for specific purposes. That's a kind of technical term, a non-refundable tax credit. What it means basically is that you're given a certain amount of money that you can allocate to nonprofit purposes of your choice. But everybody gets the same amount. It's a fixed non-refundable tax credit for each person rather than bigger tax credits in the form of tax deductions, the wealthier you are. All right, so all of that is about the second complexity of the tax system, a complexity that's based on the use of taxes for public policy by directing incentives for people to allocate their resources in particular ways. And for each of those policy purposes, you're adding complexity to the tax code, often for very good reason. A third type of complexity, deductions that reduce the fairness of taxation. This is the problem of loopholes. If you don't like a deduction, you call it a loophole. If you like a deduction, you call it a tax deduction to adjust for good purposes, right? If you don't like it, then you call it a loophole. It's a way of getting around fair taxation. Certainly when it was reported that Mitt Romney paid a smaller percentage of taxes than his secretaries, people felt there was something amiss there, that there was some way in which he was manipulating the tax system for his advantage rather than simply taking legitimate, fair, and appropriate deductions. So here's an example. Home mortgage interest deductions. A rich person with a $1 million mortgage on an expensive house and a $10,000 a month interest payment and a marginal tax rate of 35% saves $3,500 a month or $42,000 a year. So our home mortgage interest deductions give this wealthy person $42,000 a year in order to be able to buy this expensive house more cheaply. A working class person who buys a home with a $100,000 mortgage with a $1,000 a month interest payment and only a 15% marginal tax rate saves $150 a month or $1,800 a year. The rich person's house costs 10 times more than the poor person's house, but the tax subsidy is over 23 times more. There's something kind of weird about this from a point of view of fairness. It's one thing if the house costs 10 times more, the subsidy being 10 times more. Well, that's a kind of proportional subsidy to the cost of a house. But because the income tax mortgage deduction is pegged to the income of the earner, the richer you are, the bigger the deduction, proportionately. For the same reason that the richer you are, the higher the percentage you pay in taxes. So the fact that we peg deductions to the same tax bracket logic that we peg income means that you amplify the benefit for the same kind of contribution to the rich. These two people each buy a house. The rich person's house costs 10 times more, but we give more subsidies proportionately to rich people to buy expensive houses than to poor people to buy modest houses. And I think when you think of it that way, most people would, I think, feel a little uncomfortable. There's something not quite right about having more tax subsidies go to wealthy people buying expensive houses than to working class people buying modest houses. Or another example, corporations can count as business expenses all sorts of things which are disguised forms of consumption. Executives get company cars, which they can use for their private purposes. They get a fancy $200,000 luxury vehicle. That's counted as a business expense. Private corporate jets, which can be used by the executives for vacation purposes. They're still corporate jets, and the corporate jet is a tax deduction. Or corporate meetings in Hawaii resorts. You know the story. All these sorts of things. When governments do it, it's referred to as boondoggles. If a government department has a retreat in a fancy Hawaii resort, it would be a boondoggle. When corporations do it, it's just a business expense. But the business expense is deductible from taxes. And therefore, those corporate meetings held in fancy resorts are subsidized by taxpayers. We're using part of our collective resources that we decide are needed to solve collective problems, that some of these can be allocated to private corporations to have luxurious resort retreats. Well, maybe there's good reasons for that, maybe not. Most people, I think, are uncomfortable with that kind of thing. It has the feel of something that's a bit corrupt. But it's generally, these are seen as loopholes. It's a way of reducing your tax liability by allocating certain things which really should be thought of as private expenditures and treating them as deductions. Myths and realities about taxes in the U.S. Now, you'd think if on the basis of what politicians say, that we are a heavily taxed economy, a heavily taxed society. In fact, we are not. Now, this data is a little bit out of date. As I said, because of my accident, I really wasn't able, in general, to update all the data from the last time I taught the class. But nothing has changed in any fundamental way. The average level of taxation in the OECD, that's the kind of club of economically developed economies, the average rate of taxation in the OECD is 33.8% in 2010. Denmark and Sweden are just under 50%. That is, just under 50% of all income generated in their big economic pie gets allocated for public purposes. So they've decided in those countries to roughly divide the total pie in half between things, resources that can be used for health, education, roads, parks, elder care, daycare, childcare, all sorts of other kinds of services which are not familiar to us, and all sorts of subsidies for various sorts of activities. They decide to allocate about half of the total pie for that purpose. In the United States, it's about a quarter. Canada, which in many ways is quite like the United States, is at 31%. Well, so the first thing to note is that we are really at the bottom of the pack among developed industrial rich countries. Are taxes fair in the US? So this is a comparison of the tax rates for different kinds of taxes for the people in the bottom 20% of the income distribution compared to the top 1%. I think these are actually households, not individuals. So households in the bottom 20% compared to households in the top 1%. For sales and excise taxes, that is taxes on things that you buy, it amounts to less than 1% of the earnings of people in the top 1%, but 7% of the income of people in the bottom 20%. Same for property taxes. It's a higher percentage of the income of the poor than of the rich. Personal income taxes, the bottom 20% do pay less than the top 1%. But on total taxes, when you add up everything, these are state and local taxes, by the way. This table is for state and local taxes. For total taxes, the bottom 20% pay more than the top 1%. Taxes are not fair in the United States by any reasonable evaluation, and they're not high in the United States. So in spite of the fact that we live in a period where tax cuts seem to be a central feature of the political life of the country and of our state, and a constant mantra of taxes being too high and the need to cut taxes in order to stimulate growth and so on, the fact is our tax system is not fair. It taxes the bottom more than the top, and our taxes are low. Whenever, therefore, you're in a discussion where important public policies are being discussed about things that need to be done to improve life in the United States, and someone says, well, we can't afford it, it's simply not true. We may not choose to spend it, that's another question, but the constraint is not that we can't afford it. Our budgetary capacity is constrained by our willingness to accept higher taxes, not by our ability to accept higher taxes. The attack on the affirmative state. Well, I won't be able to get through all of this. I think what I'll do, the next lecture is on the media. So I'll start the part on the attack on the affirmative state now and finish it at the beginning of the next lecture and then segue into the discussion of the media then. So a definition of the affirmative state. I use the expression the affirmative state. I prefer it to things like the interventionist state or the welfare state. I think the expression affirmative captures better this comprehensive notion of a state that affirms our collective and common interests and does something about them. A state which provides a wide range of public goods and plays an active role in solving social problems and advancing public purposes. So here's just a list of affirmative state activities. Education, both K through 12 and higher education, lifelong learning, skill retraining, infrastructure, providing health care and preventative health, elder care and daycare for preschool children, public safety, subsidies for the arts and recreation, and regulations for things like pollution, health and safety in the workplace, food quality and product safety, truthful advertising. All of these things require resources, and other things constitute the range of activities that are the responsibility of a well-developed and active affirmative state. What then are the core defenses of the affirmative state? So first, democracy as a value. Here the issue is the appropriate scope of state activity for a robust democratic society. Remember again my central idea that I've been trying to elaborate for you about democracy is that democracy is the way in which we enact the value of self-determination when the context requires our cooperation as members of a community. It's the way we solve collective problems that we all face, where we allocate resources and impose rules that govern our lives as members of an interacting cooperative community. So the affirmative state affirms the democracy as a value by saying that the appropriate scope for that collective problem solving is pretty wide, because there's a whole range of things which are much better handled when they're done cooperatively and collectively than when they are left up to the market and individuals. Expansive public goods and economic regulation are necessary also for the values of efficiency, prosperity, and fairness. So these public goods are not simply appropriate topics within a democratic, a deeply and expansively democratic society. But it turns out that if you really take seriously the need for all of these public goods of the affirmative state, this is actually good for the values of efficiency, prosperity, and fairness, those other values which we talked about in the first part of the course. And finally, for a core defense of the affirmative state, I think it's really central for the value of freedom itself. Not just the value of democracy, understood as the way in which we collectively can solve our common problems, but an affirmative state actually is enabling of the value of freedom, understood as positive freedom, the ability of people to actually put their life plans into effect, to be able to act on their preferences, not simply be free from coercion of others. That also requires an affirmative state. We are all more free in a world with good public infrastructure than with lousy public infrastructure. It's an enhancement of our freedom to be able to move around easily and safely. It's not just that it's more efficient for the economy. It's actually an enhancement of individual capacity for individual self-determination. So, I think, and this is what puts me on the liberal left side of the political spectrum, that if you really care about democracy, efficiency, prosperity, fairness, and freedom, those values we grappled with at the beginning of the semester, then we need an affirmative state, and it needs resources. So a low tax regime is antithetical to democracy, efficiency, prosperity, fairness, and freedom. That's the defense of the affirmative state. Well, needless to say, there is a counter argument. There is an attack on the affirmative state. And this is an attack that has escalated since the early 1980s. It's generally thought of in a bit of a stylized way that the big dividing line around the value of public service and the affirmative state, the real dividing line in American political history comes with the Reagan administration in the early 1980s. In Britain, it's seen as associated with Thatcher. in the similar period. There are three kinds of attacks that have underwritten this very prolonged assault on the idea of this positive vision of the role of government. First, there's an attack on the legitimacy of taxes, the constant reiteration of the idea that taxation is oppressive, that the government is taking away your money. The assault on taxation really began in earnest in the 1970s, but it escalated significantly in the 80s, and then has taken on a centrality in American politics in the last 15 or 20 years that's really quite extraordinary. In some contexts, it's basically the only policy that conservatives consistently push through legislatures is tax cuts. That's the centerpiece of the political project. That's the first prong of the attack. The second is the attack on the intentions of government. Big government is oppressive. It wants to dominate, regulate, and control your lives for the benefits of bureaucrats. Politicians and bureaucrats are fundamentally corrupt. Now, whatever you might think about the desirability of taxation in the affirmative state, if you believe that the actual people in positions to run the state are intrinsically concerned about their own domination, they want to dominate, that's the driving force, and that they are hopelessly corrupt and lining their own pockets, that the purpose of taxation is not the public good, it's the private good of bureaucrats and politicians. If you really believe in the malevolent state, that it has these ill purposes, then of course you'll oppose the affirmative state. Not because you oppose it in principle, it's not because you think it wouldn't be a good thing if it could do the things it claims to do, it's just that you don't believe it does the things it claims to do. And finally, and then I'll end here, the third prong of the attack is the attack on the competence of government. Even if it has good intentions, big government is filled with red tape, incompetent, stupid regulations that generate great inefficiencies. The state, the government, is all thumbs and no fingers. It just can't do what it claims to do. They may have the best of intentions. They may be good-hearted people. Bureaucrats may not all be malevolent, no gooders, no goodniks. They may have the best of intentions in mind, but they are simply incompetent. The idea that government should be run like a business and that corporate leaders are experts in competence, whereas government leaders are incompetent, is another aspect of this prolonged attack on the affirmative state. Okay, we'll end there, and I'll finish up this part of the lecture on Thursday. See you then.